Welcome to Journeys to Orthodoxy, a production of the Icon New Media Network, where Orthodox Christianity is the future of American spirituality. Journeys to Orthodoxy can be heard on the Orthodox Christian Network at www.myocn.net. I'm your host, Jacob Lee.
This week on Journeys, a man named Zacchaeus. Welcome to Journeys to Orthodoxy. I'm your host, Jacob Lee. And today, with me on the phone, I have Zacchaeus. How are we doing, Zacchaeus?
Pretty good. How are you?
Good. And Zacchaeus, this is not your birth name, but your Orthodox name. Am I correct?
That's correct. Yes, I'm a convert.
A convert to Orthodoxy, and you're in North Carolina these days?
Yes, Asheville, North Carolina.
Great. So, Zacchaeus, where did you grow up? Did you grow up there in Asheville?
I moved here when I was about 19 and or 20, and I grew up, I would say, generally in the Raleigh area.
Okay. So you're a North Carolina native.
I am.
There we go. And you are a convert to the Orthodox Church, and you converted how many years ago?
I converted about 8 years ago, so I'm 28, when I was about 20 years old.
Great. And how did you grow up? What did you grow up with a religion?
My family was divorced, and so I lived with my two brothers and my mom in like I said, around the Raleigh area in North Carolina. And we were raised Protestant, basically Baptist, until about the time I was about 12.
And so were you just a Southern Baptist, First Baptist?
It was... Well, they have so many Baptists now, so that's, I believe we were considered what they call free will Baptist.
Okay. And, go ahead.
Which, of course, you know, just for clarification's sake, I believe free will Baptists are the ones that do not believe in predestination. They believe that you have a free will to choose your own destiny, if you will.
So in the Protestant world, they're on the Armenian side of the argument.
Yes.
Okay. And you grew up, this was the religion of your mother and your father?
Yeah, the religion basically of my ancestors. I have a lot of German background and stuff, and her family, of course, raised her Baptist and so on and so forth, and their parents, and all the way back to Europe, I believe.
Okay. So I know you had a kind of life-changing experience at age 12, or thereabouts. What was that?
Well, as I was going to church, I actually got very active. I had always been active in church, and as I got a little bit older and I was able to think for myself, generally in the Baptist denomination, they hold to the tradition that you have to be around 12 years old before you become baptized, because they don't believe in infant baptism, and they don't believe that because they want the individual to make the decision for themselves. So the time came when I was contemplating baptism in the Baptist church. And as I did that, as I started asking the preacher more questions, and I had a little meeting with him about what it means to be baptized and what's going to happen after that, and that I'll always be saved and everything, he couldn't answer fundamental questions that I had about Christianity's history. I mean, in other words, he would tell me things that would happen and what I would inherit, but he couldn't tell me anything other than the Bible, and I wanted to know more. And at that point, I stopped going because I told my mother that I'm not going to be baptized into a church that can't answer all my questions. And at that point, I stopped.
Okay. And what were any more specific, any specific questions that you had that just so our listeners might know?
Sure. Well, mainly it was about Scripture just as a whole. It was, where did the Scripture come from? And how do I know that these writings are real? And why do other denominations baptize as babies, and we baptize, of course, I'm referring to the Baptists when I say we at that point. I asked the preacher, I was curious on why the Baptists baptize the individual at 12 years old instead of as an infant. So it was basically those two main points. It was the preacher couldn't answer questions about the history of Scripture, and he couldn't really give me an answer on why in some denominations they baptize as infants, and in some denominations they baptize around 12 years old.
Got it. Okay. And so what did that kind of void of information lead you to journey into or discover?
Well, I was, at that point, I became real disenchanted with Protestant Christianity, mainly because they could not give me the answers that I was looking for. And it started there with those two main points, but it just snowballed into what about saints? And where did they go? And who came after St. Paul? And why do you call your denomination Baptist? Well, they say that they trace the roots all the way back to John the Baptist, but there was this big gap between, you know, the time of the apostles and, you know, the 16th century or something like that. So as I began to sort of take this journey, I just became more displeased with it. And then I actually got to a point where not only was I disenchanted with Protestantism, especially Baptist, but I was almost hostile towards it. I was to a point where I was almost offended with what they had done to Christianity. They had dissolved everything down into the Bible, and that's it. That's all they had. And for me, that wasn't enough.
The sola scriptura thing wasn't working for you.
No, it was not.
So, Zacchaeus, where did that lead you?
At that point, when I was, like I said earlier, disenchanted with Protestantism, I still had a spiritual thirst, and I kept searching for something, you know, greater than myself. And I still believed in God, you know, even though I was unhappy with Protestantism. And to a degree, I still believed that Jesus Christ was God, but because of all of the unhappiness that I experienced in Protestantism, I was almost to the point where I was rejecting that Jesus Christ was God. And I actually did get to that point. When I rejected Jesus Christ as God, I kept going on the spiritual path, looking at other religions, Islam, Hindu, Buddhist. And at that point, I was around 14 years old. And I'll never forget, I was riding in a car, and I was spending some time with some high school friends, and I was a freshman and very impressionable. And this guy was playing Bob Marley. And it was the song, Sun is Shining. and it was from one of his albums, and I heard that, and at that point, there was something coming through in the music where I felt like this guy was really talking about something real. And at that point, I was basically hooked on Bob Marley. And so I started investigating him, listening to more of his music, and everything he talked about in the music was scripture-based. So that really hit home for me. You know, it was scripture-based. He was quoting the Psalms or anything from the New Testament. He has lyrics from that that he uses and stuff. And so it was like it was almost like he was really preaching the true Jesus, the Jesus that forgives, the Jesus that doesn't judge, the Jesus that you don't have to dress up to go to church on Sunday, something tangible, something that I could relate to. And at that point, I found out that Bob Marley worshipped, you know, a man named Haile Selassie I, or King of Ethiopia, and they called him Rastafari. And I converted to Rastafarianism at that point. So, and then that began a whole other spiritual journey at that crossroad.
Now, what exactly is Rastafarianism for our listeners who don't know?
Sure. Rastafari is basically two words. It's the word Ras, which means king, and then Tafari, which is actually his name. So before Haile Selassie I was coronated or crowned emperor of Ethiopia, his name as a prince was Rastafari. And so when these, there was a man named Marcus Garvey. He was basically a black preacher. He was actually Protestant. He was from Jamaica in the early 1900s, late 1800s. He was a preacher, sort of a black radicalist. And he preached that there would be a black king crowned in Africa and that he would be the Messiah. There was a lot of controversy if he made that speech or not. Nobody actually knows. Nonetheless, the Jamaican people believed him. And when this prince, Rastafari, was made emperor of Ethiopia, he took on the name Haile Selassie I, it means power of the Trinity or might of the Trinity. And he took on the name King of Kings, Lord of Lords, conquering line of the tribe of Judah, elect of himself. And especially the poor Jamaican people, they actually believed that he was the second coming of Jesus Christ. So not only was Ethiopia a physical heaven, that you could go there and live by Jesus, at his side, it was also a spiritual journey as well. Ethiopia was seen as the spiritual homeland. And so that is who Haile Selassie was. And little did I know that he was a coronated Ethiopian Orthodox Christian king and that his whole dynasty was based on Orthodox Christianity for almost 1,500 years.
So it was kind of a Orthodox spinoff cult kind of thing. Is that what you're?
Yeah, it was a. So yeah, it's more of like a Messianic. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but sort of a Messiah cult, and it originated in the 1930s. Well, yeah, I think Selassie was crowned in 1931. It's true. He was an amazing man. He did a lot of great things for his country. It's also said that he would invite lions into his basically his courtyard, and they would lay down like dogs at the side of him because he was such a holy person. So, do I believe that he was a holy person? Absolutely, definitely. And at that point, I believe that he was the second coming of Jesus Christ. as I took upon this Rastafarian faith. As time progressed, Rastafarians, some believe that he was the reincarnation of Jesus Christ, not just the second coming, but he was reincarnated. And then there was some other beliefs as well, that Jesus Christ was still Jesus and Haile Selassie was still Selassie. They were two different people, but they were essentially doing the same work, or they were doing God's work on earth. And as Rastafarianism grew, these different groups of believers started to take on these slightly different belief systems of who he was. And as I got older, into 16, 17, and 18 years old, I started noticing these differences in Rastafarianism. And once again, I was unhappy because the truth was, it was skewed. There was no definite line to what they believed anymore. And I became unhappy. So at that point, I started doing more research on who Selassie was, who he was, and what he did. And at that point, I also read a book. I'd read maybe 10 different books about Bob Marley. And finally, I was looking at a box set. It's a box set of CDs. And in the very back of the box set, there's a little paragraph, and the last sentence of the paragraph said that Bob Marley was baptized with a new name called Bernhe Selassie. It means I believe might of the Trinity. It has something to do with the Trinity. That's what the word Selassie means. Well, when I read that, it said he was baptized into the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. So I was like, okay, well, this guy that I had admired for 6 years, Bob Marley, had been baptized. He had been a Rastafarian for his whole life. But on his deathbed, he was baptized as a Christian into the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. So for many years, this man, Bob Marley, worshipped Selassie as God. Then, in the end, he actually took upon the faith of Selassie himself, which was Orthodox Christianity. So when I read that, I immediately started doing research about Ethiopian Orthodoxy. And went to libraries and started reading about Ethiopian Orthodoxy.
And what did you find out about, I mean, were you able to find much material on Ethiopian Orthodoxy?
Generally, no. it's a very mysterious faith. I mean, even to Orthodox people, Russians, Greeks, Bulgarians, American Orthodox, Ethiopia is sort of shrouded in mystery with the way that they hold fast to their Orthodox traditions, and not a lot of information was out there at that time, and at this point it was about 1999. I did do some research and went to a library. I call it a one-horse town. That's the way we say it here in North Carolina. It basically means there's nobody there. It's a small library. I go inside and start looking for Ethiopian Orthodox books, and there is none. So reluctantly, I sit down at the computer, which at that time I know nothing about, nor the internet. And I started doing research, and I saw that the Ethiopian church, they had these seven sacraments. I didn't know what that was all about. And they had these bishops and archbishops, and so I started trying to write them, but I didn't even have an email address. I didn't even know how to get an email address. So I was writing them. I don't know how or what I thought I was doing, but then they weren't responding. So over a period of a couple weeks, I was like, okay, well, I'm not getting any replies back, but I didn't really know how to use a computer. So, well, eventually a gentleman came up behind me, the librarian, and he asked me, you know, do you need some help? And I told him yes. I'm looking for information about Ethiopian Orthodoxy. And he said, well, you're in luck. I'd go to a Russian Orthodox church. So I got his name and number. His name is actually Daniel. And the next Sunday, we connected, and I went with him to Raleigh. And it was an OCA mission there at an Episcopal diocesan house. That's actually where they held the services. And I walked in, and it was during the sixth hour, just before the liturgy on Sunday. And the priest was doing the sensing while chanting Psalm 50, and he was a simple priest, and he served with no socks, only sandals, and just very humble. He would never say that. But when I walked in, I knew that I had reached the end of my journey. I knew that finally I had found what I had been looking for since the age of 12, that all of my heart's desires to find true Christianity had finally arrived at that point. And I totally rejected Rastafarianism at that point. I knew that if Bob Marley could convert, and that if he knew in his heart on his deathbed that Orthodoxy was the truth, then that says a lot. And I never looked back at that point.
Now, what about the service, or what about it besides the priests of bare feet that you just knew that it was it? What, was there an overwhelming presence? Was it the incense, the icons? I mean, what is
there
it about?
There was a few things. Yeah, that's a good question. You know, and looking back on it, it seems sort of trivial of what hooked me. But I always like to think about it like this. I mean, in regards to this question, at the end of the liturgy, when the priest does the prayer from the ambo, he says, "Bless those that love the beauty of thy house." And for different people, God works with them in different ways. And for artists, it could be the icons. You know, maybe they're a worldly artist. They paint Renaissance or some other kind of abstract thing, and then all of a sudden they're subjected or introduced to icons, and it just draws them in, and then that's how they convert. For me, it wasn't the icons. They were definitely mysterious and very reverent, if you will, but it was the simplicity of the priest. It was his long hair. It was his beard. It was the chanting of the psalms that I knew somehow inertly inside of me that the way that they were performing the service was actually the correct way. I can't tell you how I knew it, but the way that it was carried out, It was orderly. People were standing. Nobody was listening to a preacher randomly pick a verse out of the Bible for a Sunday and give a sermon about it. And the incense, I knew, because after reading the Psalms, that incense was offered to God in the temple. And it just seemed right. And so those were a few things that really drew me in.
So it was kind of the overall presence.
It was the overall presence, and it was just the order. It wasn't in disarray. You know, in Protestant churches, you have people coming and going. They're sitting down, and you know, some are picking their nose, and some are following along and writing stuff down as the preacher says something. You know, that's fine if that's how they choose to do it. But there's something about it when you see faithful people and you know, sitting or standing. But as the priest is going around and reverently sensing people and chanting a psalm while he does so, you know, human beings are naturally inclined to rituals. You know, St. Dorotheus of Gaza says, never underestimate the power of routine. And it says a lot because humans, we create things. That's, we're made in the image of the Creator. We like to beautify temples, and we like to... There's something about a ritual that fully expresses the mystical side of the human spirit. And I think, and I fully believe, that in Orthodox worship, it embodies that natural instinct towards a ritualistic service.
Fair enough. Now, where did you convert? You converted at that parish?
Yeah, I knew that I was moving to Asheville. So keep in mind, that was in Raleigh when that happened. Asheville's about 4 hours away or so. I was in the process of buying a house with my brother. So I knew I was going to move up to Asheville. So the priest, who's actually retired now, his name is Father Andrew, great man, he said, you know, don't worry about becoming a catechumen right now, because I was only going to be there for a few months. He said, just go on up to Asheville and become a catechumen there. So when I moved to Asheville, I gave the priest a call here, and he took me under his wing, and he gave me my Orthodox name on Theophany, and I chose Zacchaeus for my name. And I was made a catechumen here in Asheville in the year 2000.
Got it. And what was it like, I guess, what was your catechumenate like? Did you have formal classes? How long did it take? Kind of give our listeners an idea of...
Yeah, that's a good question. For me, I had a lot of baggage. I had a lot of spiritual ideas that I carried over into Orthodoxy, and I think that was one of my downfalls. On a side note, something that's maybe of interest for the listeners as well is I got to a point where in my catechumenate, maybe about 3 months down the road or something like that, I was really concerned about spending a lot of money to beautify the temple. In Orthodox churches, of course, you know, we have, you know, golden-plated gospels and golden candelabras in the altar and different kind of things that cost a lot of money for the church. And there was a specific icon that was painted, or written, rather, if you will, for the church, and it cost the church about $4,500. It was hand-painted, and it was a pantocrator that goes in the top of the dome. And I was irritated by that because I was thinking, why don't we sell the icon and give the money to the poor? You know, why don't we do something charitable with our money instead of having a painted picture of Jesus that nobody's going to see unless they look up? And what's interesting about that is that that's the same thing Judas said when Christ, you know, he had the oil that I think Mary Magdalene was anointing his feet with. And Judas said, why don't we take the money and sell this and take the money and give it to the poor? And it was like a spiritual revelation. I realized that at that point, man creates things, and it is our God-given right, and God is pleased by us actually beautifying a temple. So that was one of the hang-ups that I had as a catechumen. Sort of funny, but... And generally, my catechumen, it was like about a year. I was baptized on Great and Holy Saturday, I think, the following year. And I didn't really... There were some formal classes that I went to. I would have to say yes, there were formal classes that I went to. And thanks be to God, I you know, I was baptized and I'm able to work out my salvation in the faith, so I'm happy.
Great. And since you've become Orthodox, some of your other family members have as well?
Yes. Glory be to God. My mom converted about 3 years later. Actually left and joined a monastery. I say joined. I mean, I lived there pursuing monastic life, like testing my vocation, if you will. So during that time I was living in a monastery, my mom converted as well at the same church that I first went to in Raleigh.
Now, what led your mother to convert? Was it? I'm guessing it had to do with your conversion.
You know, yes, I definitely would have to say, and you know, and also, I really think it has a lot to do with me being in the monastery because I saw a lot of things happen in the world while I was living in the monastery, for good and for worse. I think. And I'm just going to say this, and maybe I'm wrong, so I'm not pretending to know a lot here. But, you know, I think it was pleasing for, you know, to God that I was in the monastery, and it really helped my mom convert. For one reason or another, I don't know why. We didn't really have a lot of communication. I mean, I would write her letters. It wasn't like she was, you know, asking me a bunch of questions about the Bible or why do the Orthodox cross themselves? I mean, I wasn't there to really answer her questions generally. On some things I was, but overall it was her. So I can't speak for her, but I think it had a lot to do with me being Orthodox already, yeah.
Now, have any of your other family members come into the Orthodox faith?
No other family members. I've got two brothers, and one of my brothers does come to church quite regularly and has mentioned his desire to be baptized. So that's good. And God willing, he'll be baptized. So that's something going on right now. The other brother, he has, you know, a family and stuff and lives out of state, and he's not Orthodox, and neither is my dad. So just me and my mom right now, and her brother is interested.
Great. And as a, you know, someone who's been Orthodox for a little while, kind of looking back, coming from Rastafarianism, I'm sure quite a bit changed, but what changed in your life when you became Orthodox? What do you think the people outside looking at you saw or have seen?
I've had some people that aren't Orthodox, basically, like old friends, they'll see me a couple years later, and I'm not very good at staying in touch with my friends, and they all know that, which is horrible. So it's like once a year I'll talk to somebody out of state, and they'll say, "Oh, are you still that Orthodox thing or whatever that is?" And I'll say, "Yes, of course. You know, that's who I am. That is what defines me." Or that's how I wish to be defined, is just simply that. But so I think a lot of people didn't really expect me to stick it out. I lived a very worldly life. I was and am still attached to worldly things. But by the grace of God, I've been able to continue in the walk and stay Orthodox and struggle, and I think that in and of itself was sort of a shock to people. They didn't really expect me to, because as you just heard, I went through a whole spiritual journey. I mean, I was all kind of weird religions, and then I was the strange Rastafarian thing for so long, or 6 years or whatever, and so they basically thought it was a whim, and I think that's one of the most surprising things, that how people view me.
Now, your time in the monastery, you were pursuing full monastic life, and what was that like?
It was by far the best experience that I've ever had. in my entire life and the most difficult. There's, of course, different levels that, you know, you go there as a seeker and you just wear your normal clothes and you live the life of the community. And then eventually you're given a cassock or a podraznik, if you will, in Russian, and they give you the black clothing. You put that on. Now you're a trudnik, which basically means worker. And then you continue in that. Then they make you a novice. Then you have the formal title of brother. So Brother Zacchaeus was what I was called. The monastery that I lived, it was the Hermitage of the Holy Cross Monastery under the Russian Orthodox Church Abroad jurisdiction in Wayne, West Virginia. Incredible community and great brotherhood. And I lived there, and the time that I spent there was, I had never experienced that kind of quietness in my life. And I think one of the major thing that I got from that experience was retraining my mind, because in the world you're so used to having everything at your own will, basically at any point you want it, whether it's television, whether it's the internet, or even the lights. You want something, you just go out and do it. And it creates for a person a real detachment of suffering. We don't know what it's like to suffer. We think we do, but we don't really have any idea. And in the monastery, it's basically like I was broken down into a child. My mind was basically reconstructed. I had to learn how to suffer. I had to learn what it was like to not have. And in Orthodox spirituality, it's a great thing. Maybe for Protestant people, you know, if you're listening, it's maybe hard to understand. But, you know, it says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for they shall see God." Or, yeah, "Blessed are the pure in heart," and or "Blessed are the poor in spirit." You know, it's basically this joyful sorrow that I experienced in the monastery that I'll never forget, and that has stayed with me throughout my whole, you know, rest of my Orthodox life. So it was great. It was really great.
And you received the blessing of the abbot there to leave?
My spiritual father at the time still is, was not the abbot. The abbot of the monastery was my spiritual father in the beginning, and another monk was actually ordained to the priesthood, and I sort of went under his wing. And they gave me a blessing to leave and pursue the married life.
Okay. And what was it like re-entering the world for those of us who've never been to a monastery, lived in a monastery, and then left?
Well, it was incredible. I must say, it was like a fish out of water. Underneath the, you know, the cassock, you generally wore black, maybe a black t-shirt and black pants under it or something like that. So that's the only clothes that I had to go back to the world with, was just solid black. I felt like Johnny Cash. And not only was that funny, but the incense that they make at the monastery has talc powder that keeps it from sticking together. It's like a white powder.
Mm-hmm.
And I left with a whole bunch of incense in my suitcase, and it was the exact same time that the anthrax scare was going on. So I was held up at the airport, because here's a strange-looking guy with long beard, long hair, wearing all black and carrying around jars of little powder things with white dust everywhere. So I got searched, and it was pretty humiliating. So that was my first experience of going back into the world. And it was definitely hard to get used to, and there was a median that I needed to find. I needed to find a middle ground I was so used to strict spiritual life. And in the world, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to live a life of inner prayer. Now, you might say your prayers in the morning and at the evening time, like most Orthodox people do, but the inner stillness that is coveted in the monastery, it's very hard to get that in the world. And I was having trouble, you know, finding that inner stillness. And, you know, could I watch TV? Could I not watch TV? What should I watch? Could I watch an R movie? If so, yes, when? There's all these questions. I didn't know how to take it all in. So in time, I finally reached a point where I could have a good filter. I could say yes or no to certain things, and I finally found a happy medium.
What is your involvement now with the Orthodox Church in your local parish?
I'm currently the choir director at St. Nicholas Russian Orthodox Church in Asheville, North Carolina. I'm the choir director there. I spent a lot of time in the monastery, so when you're doing the daily cycles of the services for almost 2 years straight, you get pretty good at, you know, the routine and how everything works. So I had a lot of training there, serving in the altar as well. So when I came back here to Asheville a little while ago, about over a year and a half ago, I've been serving as the choir director in the parish and basically doing the services. We have three services a week: Wednesday night, Vespers; Saturday night, we do vigil; Sunday, of course, liturgy; and then any major 12 feast days or any kind of local feast day like St. Nicholas or some others. And we try to do as many as possible, and that's basically my role, just help out there and chant the services.
You just had a visitor to your parish this weekend?
Yeah, we did. So today's Monday, and it was this past Friday. It was our paternal feast, St. Nicholas. There's two feasts a year, but it's the fall feast is the one we celebrate. We have a new bishop, Bishop George. He actually is residing at Holy Cross Monastery in Wayne, West Virginia. He's the very first Bishop of the South for the Russian Orthodox Church abroad. So it's a huge blessing. And the overall feeling at the bishop's visit was just great, because all the clergy came from all around the South, and we were just so happy to have a bishop of the South. And not only that, but it's Bishop George is a great man. He wouldn't tell you that, but it's true. And it was a great time. We had a lot of visitors from all over the South, many different priests. I think we had maybe 12 priests and some other different deacons and stuff. So it was a really great moment for us.
You guys are on the old calendar. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. We are. We're on the old calendar, and so on Christmas we'll be celebrating St. John of Kronstadt, and then January 7th it's Nativity for us.
And for our listeners that don't know, there are two calendars in the Orthodox Church, one that's, I guess, synced up with the Western part of the world, mm-hmm. and one that's still on the Eastern part of the world, and mm-hmm. in America we kind of find ourselves halfway in between.
Exactly, exactly. And you know, I have a buddy, his name's Herman, he's a great guy. He currently goes to the OCA church nearby, but he also, for other services, will come over to our church, and so we always pick on him about the fasting rules and this and that. But you know, the bottom line is that, you know, calendars, they don't matter. I mean, they do, but they don't. And we shouldn't place a lot of emphasis on them, and they've been a source of derision or division in the past, but I think as people, you know, grow older in Orthodox faith, it's not so much of a hang-up for them. So, you know, if you are listening and you're a Protestant and you do come to this understanding about the old and the new calendar, don't get hung up on it. It's not a big deal.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you, Zacchaeus, for joining me today on Journeys to Orthodoxy.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot, Jacob.
Have a wonderful Nativity, whatever day you celebrate it.
Thanks. You as well, sir. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to Journeys to Orthodoxy, a production of the Icon New Media Network, where Orthodox Christianity is the future of American spirituality. Would you like to share your journey with us? Please do so by contacting us at journeys@iconnewmedianetwork.com. Journeys to Orthodoxy can be heard on the Orthodox Christian Network at www.myocn.net.